Chris Preston.
And I'm Brad Zimmerman.
And welcome to Street Check, the best two-person podcast in the history of Cabot Wealth Network. Brad, you a few months ago, we made fun of you on here. Well, it wasn't mercilessly, but lightheartedly, about you. You had been doing some volunteer work to serve hot dogs at spring training games, I believe, and other foods. But that finally paid off this past weekend. Explain.
Yeah, so we volunteer at spring training games. We get a portion of the take. Raised 17 grand for my daughter's choir group, and they just got back from Disney last weekend. Near as I can tell by my math, my volunteer efforts sent one adult chaperone who could have paid for their own ticket and five kids to Disney. They all had a blast, rode the roller coasters, saw fireworks, hotel stay. Daughter is excited to continue going for the next 2 years, and my food handler's card is good through 2026, I believe. So I'll be volunteering for this foreseeable future, slinging dogs, making tacos, basically running the kitchen.
Nice.
Seems like it was worth my time.
Yeah, buy Disney stock now.
That 0.0001 EPS that my volunteer efforts kick in are going to be a big difference maker.
Hey, yeah, could the way earnings season is going, every little bit counts. Okay, so tell people about speaking of earnings, what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, this week we are going to talk about the very, very brief resurgence of the meme stocks. We are going to talk about some of the inflation data we saw this week. It's sort of a mixed bag. We will do a sort of final wrap up of earnings, and then we are talking Warren Buffett, talking Berkshire shareholder meeting, his recent moves, and then I have some context that I want to add for one of his favorite indicators. Actually, it's the indicator that he said if you could only have one indicator, it should be this one. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the pod.
Yeah, good tease. And speaking of which, sticking with the Buffett theme, you're up for defend the take this week. And your take is related to Buffett. It's that Berkshire Hathaway will outperform the S&P for the rest of the year. You have 90 seconds. Go.
So this is partially a thematic take because we're talking Buffett. It's also, an easy one to track for Chris and I at the end of the year. But looking back at the returns for Berkshire versus the S&P, Berkshire's up 4.2% in the last month versus 5.6% for the S&P. Year to date, 13.8 for Berkshire, 11.8 for the S&P. In the last year, 25% for Berkshire, 27.3 for S&P. And in the last 5 years, 104.2% for Berkshire, 85 for the S&P. So it's not exactly a bold take. It's more of a coin toss whether it outperforms. But the reason that I'm using it as the take is the allocation in Berkshire, for me, is better than the S&P right now. They've got a relatively large cash position. Their largest holding, Apple, is actually the one that I think will weather any kind of negativity in tech better than almost any company out there, just given where its valuations are. Buffett also loves insurers, and that is one sector that has been performing really well of late. And if we do run into more macro headwinds, insurers are also likely to outperform because it's not really optional. You have to have insurance. If you're driving in the country, you need it. If you are living in the country, you need health insurance. Absent federal action of some sort, there's not really anything that is going to cap insurance profitability other than claims, right? And, there's really no black swan event that spikes insurance claims. We saw even with the pandemic that insurance claims didn't go up. People were just deferring voluntary procedures. So I like the asset composition for Berkshire for the rest of the year a lot better than something like the S&P, and I think it'll beat for the rest of the year.
Right. You went a little past the post, but I gave you some about 10 seconds leeway. I didn't realize that the history of recent outperformance, I mean, that speaks volumes about, first of all, it's hard to, go against a take that's pro-Warren Buffett, or, that's siding with Warren Buffett, right? I mean, but his outperformance, Berkshire's outperformance, the last 5 years, up 100 some percent versus 85%. that says it all about, you know, this has not been a time for value investors, value investing the last, especially the last 5 years, but really the last 10 plus years. The fact that Berkshire's still outperforming shows that this is something I've kind of tried to embrace. I took over Cabot Value Investor, one of our two value investing advisories about a month and a half ago, buying growth at value prices. You know, Warren Buffett in Berkshire's portfolio does have some plenty of pure value stocks, but he also has a lot of growth in there, as evidenced by Apple being his biggest position. And we'll get into it more later. He also has BYD, the Chinese EV, you know, surging EV giant that we've referenced a few times here, and other sort of growthy positions in his portfolio. And yeah, it's you have to go sort of a blend of growth and value to, if you're a value investor, to outperform these days. And you know, who better to do that than Warren Buffett? And I do suspect that part of this is your pessimism about the market in general, in addition to your belief in Buffett. But I still think it's a good take.
Yeah, part of it is definitely me being pessimistic on the macro. But like you said, the macro stuff, it doesn't matter until it does, right? Like underperformance of value. Value stocks do well when people are bearish, when you have a contrarian opportunity, when people are largely bullish and stocks are rocketing towards all-time highs, metrics and valuation don't matter. So part of it is definitely me being sort of intermediate to longer term bearish on the macro picture. But, you know, I didn't want to go full bear. I just wanted to pick something that I thought was maybe a little bit skewing bullish. Also, Berkshire Holding, Atlanta Braves. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. I was surprised to see that. I think it's because he has stakes in Liberty Media, which owns some of it, but I don't know. I don't know what his rationale is for all his positions. We'll get into that a little bit more later, though.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to our big three. Number one, definitely not value stocks, meme stocks. They're back this week, or they were. I think they might be past tense already. It looks like this was a false start. You know, it's not 2021 all over again. They got, after spiking, you know, nearly tripling, let's pull up the GameStop chart. This was based on one cryptic tweet by Roaring Kitty, right? Was it on Twitter?
Yes.
Literally just an image or a cartoon image of him leaning forward.
It was a cartoon of a guy holding a game controller and leaning forward in like a gaming chair, which is sort of shorthand for pay attention.
Right.
The response from the market was not, oh, let's remember what the original thesis is and wait for instructions or wait for guidance. It was, let's go buy the thing that worked last time, which is why it's cratering now. GameStop
went from 17, so a week ago, GameStop or GME was at $17 a share, went up to $48 a share, or close, I should say, at $48 a share on Tuesday of this week.
Intraday high was almost 65.
Almost 65. It is now at 20. So in the aggregate, it's gone from, in the last week, it's gone from 17 to 20 and falling, down 25%. Today. Others, you know, other than our favorite meme stocks, were in there too. AMC went from 291 a share to closing of 685 on Tuesday, now back to 456. I think there was some worry or some angst about, you know, because we've seen this before 3 years ago when this happened, Monday, Tuesday. It was like, uh-oh, is this a sign of a, is this a red flag? Is this a sign the market is getting, you know, too frothy, is topping? Just like it was kind of an early sign of it in 2021. I think it's encouraging that just as quickly as these things were bought up, meme stocks have come crashing back to earth. I think a couple of things. I think this wouldn't have happened in 2022, in first half of 2023, right? In bear markets, you wouldn't have seen this kind of fervor, even, you know, obviously very short-lived fervor over the meme stocks really at any point during the bear market. So it is, you know, partially a symptom of a bull market, I think. But I think it's equally sort of reassuring what we've been saying for months, and everyone we talked to saying, yeah, it's things are, you know, a little bit out over their skis, but this isn't the kind of, you know, Bitcoin meme stock driven rally where like everything is up and has been up for a straight year, like we saw in early 2021. So I think it's like the rally was symptom of the bull market, and the sell-off, the quick sell-off since shows that, you know, this isn't 2021 all over again.
I think it's probably a useful temperature check of sentiment, right? Yeah. Because it tells me one of two things. Either people are getting closer to that, everything is only up, it's up only always, mm-hmm. or maybe there's a desperation in it. Like, hey, I need to make this killer trade. I need to make 1,000% in a week. So I'm willing to take the gamble. That all, I mean, either of those sort of speaks to closer to exuberance than like calm, rational markets. S&P's up 27%. We'll get more into like valuation metrics later. Fundamentally, the fact that the prior meme stocks rallied is more of a condemnation of individual investors failing to understand why GameStop rallied the first time, which was structural differences or taking advantage of structural deficiencies in the market. The original rally was fueled by there being more net short shares than there were shares in existence. So the idea was that retail investors could essentially hold institutional investors hostage by acquiring shares and preventing them from closing shorts. It's essentially, or I guess to be most charitable, it's using like the tools of big money against them, right? And that was the initial push for GameStop, and that was why that first surge worked. This totally missed that. It's YOLO money getting thrown at meme names, which if you look at it that way, I think is cautionary at least, especially in the context of some of the valuation measures.
It may be more a yellow flag than a red one.
It's, I mean, but what, how do you, like, meme stocks are a frenzy. You can't apply logic to a frenzy. There's no way to really take away an important lesson from it other than know why the frenzy is happening and why it worked the first time, is my take. I think there's actually a really good short squeeze candidate out there, but I'm not going to say the name of it because I don't want to get hauled in front of congressional hearings and stuff if it actually works. But I do think that there's a good short squeeze candidate out there for like a real frenzy. We'll see how it plays out. If it works, I'll come back and claim credit for it.
Okay, great. Good tease for that may not get paid off. Okay, let's move on to number two, inflation. We got to talk about it. They're sick of talking about it, but you know, there was two more prints this week, CPI, PPI, kind of mixed. CPI number came in, I think it was even with expectations on a year-over-year basis, 3.4%, is that right? But 1% lower or less than what was expected on a month-to-month basis.
Initial report was 0.5% month-over-month increase, but that discounted the fact that the prior month had been revised down. So the actual sort of month over month comparison would have been 0.3%, which was what was expected.
Right.
So there was a little bit of a false start if you saw for like 10 minutes worth of algorithmic trading right after the report came out where it tanked and then rallied.
Yeah. But basically, bottom line, the story hasn't changed. Inflation remains in the 3 to 3.7% range that it's been in for the last year. 3.4% down slightly, but it doesn't look like it's changed expectations a whole lot on when Fed might start cutting rates. We're now at basically two-thirds of according to FactSet, not FactSet, the FedWatch tool, CME Group FedWatch tool, basically two-thirds of economists expect that there will be at least one rate hike, and some even two, or some even three, by September.
Cut by September.
And the other third expect rates to remain the same by then. That's up slightly from before this report, but not a whole lot. I don't know that this changed the narrative a whole lot. I guess it didn't worsen things, which may have been enough reason for stocks to go to all-time highs in the days after it. The market's looking for, bulls are looking for any excuse in this market to, you know, snatch up shares. And they found another one in a CPI print that was not hot after the last couple months of it coming in slightly hot.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had more takeaways on it. The Fed said higher for longer. Kashkari came out and said higher for longer. He's been sort of the shadow boogeyman for the market. Whenever he speaks, he comes out and sort of talks truth to power, we'll say. But he's a non-voting member, so he can sort of get away with saying things that, you know, other Fed members might be more political, or not political about, what's the word I'm looking for? They might be more reserved about. Powell came out, said higher for longer. Maybe we get rate cuts. I don't see inflation. I mean, it's not like it's ice cold now where we're seeing disinflation. It's sort of hovering above where they would prefer it to hover. I think economic conditions are more likely to drive rate cuts in the next 6 months than inflation conditions.
Yeah.
But even if inflation is still in the 3.4, 3, 3.1 range, it's something that, you know, you and I have talked about, like, all right, well, is the Fed comfortable with a Fed funds rate target of 2.5% or 2.75%? Maybe. It's definitely not doom and gloom. I don't see a catalyst. I don't see a clear cut catalyst for like stocks to reverse lower all of a sudden for seemingly no reason. It seems like we've sort of gotten everything out of the way. So we're just going to probably continue grinding higher, maybe get a little choppy, at least going up towards the end of the year.
Let me ask you this, because no one's been more right about what the Fed will do than we have been. Let me hold for laughter / applause. But it's kind of true. When do you think cuts will start, and how many do you think will happen this year? We've said this. We've been more skeptical about when they will start and how many there'll be than certainly most economists were at the beginning of the year and even earlier this year. What now do you think will happen?
Tinfoil hat, they give us a rate cut in September because the election is coming and they want to juice market returns. The Fed does not want to juice market returns. If they wanted to, they could give us a rate cut in September, which I think is what they'll do. I think they get a cut in September, get through the election, no cut in December. But I think they're not going to point to the fact that inflation is still hanging around. They're going to point to probably softness in the labor market. And what they're going to do is probably pull out some statistics that we have been talking about, like higher employment for part-time workers, showing, you know, maybe there's actually more weakness in the labor market than we think, or the fact that the rate hikes are now having a material impact on consumers, especially middle class and lower class consumers. I think they engineer a rate cut in September, no cut in December, unless things really, really start falling apart. So I think one this year would be my guess.
I'll agree with you that September, I think pre-election will be the first. I'll say there'll be a second in December. But you know, who really knows? We'll save these takes for our end of year hot sauce punishment episode. Okay, number three, earnings season is basically a wrap at this point. With 92% of the S&P reporting the average growth among S&P companies is 5.4%, better than expected. The best in almost 2 years since the second quarter of 2022. That makes three straight quarters of growth. And yet, there's some caveats there, which I'll let you get into. And also, it hasn't felt like a great earnings season because we've seen, as we mentioned, I think last week, similar phenomenon to what we saw, I think, in the second quarter earnings season reporting last year, where a lot of companies sold off after reporting perfectly strong earnings, you know, earnings growth even better than the 5.4% average, unless you like really blew it out of the water. If your stock was already up heading into the report, chances are if it got sold off. Now, a lot of them bounced back since, but it was sort of a, you know, wow me or we're selling you kind of an earnings season. But what are your takeaways from what we've seen in the last couple months?
So one thing that I pulled from FactSet, the Magnificent Seven companies, NVIDIA, Alphabet, Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft, those five companies were largely responsible for all earnings growth. If you exclude those five companies, year over year earnings would have declined 2.4%. Which, you know, that's consistent with what we saw with earnings reactions from companies, which is a lot of companies taking haircuts on either weak earnings or decent earnings, but weaker guidance. It's not, we don't have a booming economy right now. We have one segment of the economy that's dragging everything else up at the same time. I think that puts a lot of added importance on NVIDIA's earnings report next week. 22nd is when they report. If the Mag 7 are continuing to, you know, the Mag 7 were propping up the market for most of the last 16 months, 18 months. Yep. If they're now also propping up the economy, if we see them start missing, I think that certainly puts me back solidly, even more solidly in the bearish camp on the macro side of things. So it's going to be, I mean, it's NVIDIA's market, right? We said that 6 months ago or 4 months ago or whatever. It remains NVIDIA's market. Earnings growth was tougher for smaller businesses, tougher for larger businesses that are relying on the consumer. It's tougher for everybody except for the beneficiaries of the AI wave. So that is, for the short term, what's going to decide the market direction. I will say, though, that there was another outlier, Bristol-Myers Squibb, who drastically missed earnings, and without their contribution to the on a missing side, it would have been closer to like 8.3% earnings growth year over year for the S&P as a whole instead of that 5.4%. So there are definitely pockets of strength there, but I think, you know, like my biggest takeaway with this earnings season is, okay, yeah, it's all behind us, but pay attention to NVIDIA.
Yeah, I mean, so you're a big NBA guy, like myself. I mean, it's partly why this is named Street Check. I've forgotten now. The Heat Check, plan word.
Heat Check.
Yeah. I equated the market these days, last year and a half, as you mentioned, to a little bit like the NBA. Like if the Denver Nuggets didn't have Nikola Jokic, probably not a playoff team, or, you know, or like a 500 team, maybe, you know, Lakers back in the day, no Shaq and Kobe, they're Rick Fox and, you know, 40-year-old Robert Horry. Michael Jordan, we saw what happened when Scottie Pippen tried to fill in on his own, didn't work. The fact is, the market does have these companies. Now, if, you know, just like if a star player gets hurt in the NBA, look at the Bucks with Giannis this year, if one of those Mag 7, something happens, if they have, you know, earnings start to backslide, although we did see it with Tesla. We have seen it with Tesla. But if more of them start to, you know, start to see weakness in growth the way that some other companies are having, then you're right. I think we'll see the market backslide. But until that happens, they can carry the market the way a star player can carry an NBA team, to use that sort of loose analogy.
I thought you were going to go with the analogy is that they're the East, right? With, absent a couple of really strong teams, they're not really worth talking about. But yeah, that's apt. They're definitely holding up stock market performance. They're holding up the economic growth rate that we've been experiencing. So yeah, if things backslide for one of those five companies, yeah, it's probably not a great sign for the market. But
it happens, seems like they think they can carry the market and have been for 18 months. You'd rather see things broaden out the way that they did, what, maybe for three, four months from November through early this year. I think we're back in a little bit more of a Mag 7 driven market. Although, as all our panelists we had on last week discussed, that's not what's been hot necessarily lately. It's been, gold and metals and utilities and the banks. So yeah, it's like this dichotomy between what matters to the market the most is the Mag 7, but what's been hot has been kind of boring defensive stocks lately.
I think in absence of, because I don't really see, other than NVIDIA earnings, which I mentioned, I don't really see any upside or downside catalysts in the next like month, right? We've got until the July GDP, I think is probably the next GDP growth numbers.
Yeah.
In the absence of an upside or a downside catalyst, the market does what it traditionally does, which is drift higher. Right. I mean, there's no reason in particular to become bearish absent some catalyst. And, maybe we get profit taking or something, and maybe we get a momentum move that becomes a catalyst, but I don't see anything on the macro front that makes me more hesitant to hold stocks now than I would have been, or than I would be to hold them in like the middle of June.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably right. Okay. Let's move on to our feature segment for today, which is sort of takeaways from the Berkshire Hathaway, annual Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting from 2 weekends ago. We're almost 2 weeks removed from it, but we had a guest heavy podcast last week. So we did this sort of our first chance to discuss it. Last year, we actually had on Bruce Kayser, our, former resident value investor at Cabot, who had gone to the meetings firsthand. We don't have that kind of account this year, but we have some takeaways. Obviously, it's the first without Charlie Munger. That was a big Warren talked eloquently about him and his importance to Berkshire and important to himself as an investor. But some of the other big takeaways, they sold out some Apple. They bought, it's now revealed that they bought Chubb. Can't remember how much they expanded or how big a position they bought in Chubb.
The portfolio tracker that I'm looking at says they've got, where'd that go? $7 billion.
$7 billion
worth of Chubb. So they've got a 1.4% stake. It's 2% of Berkshire's portfolio.
Yeah. And it's an insurance, Chubb, by the way, it's an insurance company, which is, right in Berkshire's wheelhouse. They love them some insurance companies, as you mentioned earlier. But he also said, reference there being no real fat pitches to swing at now in this market. He's talking mostly from a valuation perspective, but that sort of speaks to, overvalued and, out over its skis market that we've been discussing a little bit. Warren Buffett isn't seeing anything to buy right now. It's why, probably a part of why that there's $6.4 trillion worth of money on the sidelines in money market funds right now. What were some of your takeaways?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Is like, I'm not smarter than Warren Buffett. Maybe at some stuff, maybe I'm better at cooking than he is, but I'm not.
You've proven it. You sent kids to Disney with your cooking.
Yeah. I don't know if it was quality as much as quantity. Sure. I'm certainly not a better investor than Warren Buffett. My takeaway, if he comes out on stage and says there are not fat pitches to swing at, and he's paring down exposure to tech, which has been rallying for 18 months, that should probably be telling me as an individual investor not to chase things. Right. buy stuff that you have high conviction in, take some profits. But if he doesn't see any screaming buys, by default, I don't see any screaming buys. Right.
Yeah.
Like that feels like a sort of a safe way to approach it. He's heavier in cash than they normally are, although he's always got dry powder. So I don't want to speak too much about like cash positioning. That's not necessarily anything other than maybe looking for opportunities. But if he's not buying hand over fist, maybe I shouldn't be either, or I should be more selective at least.
Yeah. I mean, you can't go wrong with taking Warren Buffett's advice, that's for sure. I guess the one thing I'll say is I mentioned at the top, he does have sort of a more of a blended value growth portfolio with the likes of Apple and BYD and others in there, but he is a little bit handcuffed as a value investor. He's looking for value, and there is, you know, by the headline numbers, there's no value, not a whole lot of value in this market, because the S&P is at a price to earnings ratio, its highest PE ratio in 3 years. It's like, it's at like 27, 28, something like that now. Not quite what it was, it was in the mid 30s in early 2021 when the meme stock, the original meme stock thing happened. But, you know, this is a, you know, the historic average for the S&P in terms of price to earnings ratio is 15, and we're at 27 right now. So it is an overvalued market, but doesn't mean stocks still can't continue to rise in an overvalued market. Question is how long?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like all the macro stuff, it's not, if people are disregarding it, it doesn't matter. You can scream from the rooftops all you want that the market is overvalued. But if the lion's share of investors come in and say, no, I think there's still more opportunity, whether it's because they see things differently or whether they are simply looking at the momentum that stocks have, then yeah, they can continue driving it higher. I mean, even if we, so I'll bring this up. I teased it a little bit in the opening. The indicator that Warren Buffett said, if you could only have one indicator, it would be this, is the total U.S. stock market value divided by gross domestic product. And what that does effectively is it says, how do we standardize all sources of growth for companies? Which the way I would position it would be, a company can grow earnings either by improving their productivity, right? You do more with what you've already got. You improve your margins. They can grow, so moving more units, selling more to existing customers, and then you get inflationary pressures that increase prices, right? So nominally earnings are rising, but some of that is being, but it's rising because of a devalued dollar. So if those are the earnings growths, how do you sort of approximate that on a large scale? And Buffett just says, hey, look at GDP. And rather than looking at just the S&P 500, which is skewed by a performance bias, because they drop underperforming companies out, he looks at the total value of the stock market. Right now, the U.S. stock market is trading at 200% of GDP, which is the same level it was trading at in 2000, right before the tech bubble burst, and is only below where it was trading in 2021. When it got above, it got to like 207% or 210% of GDP. So that's two standard deviations above its average, which means it's very extended. The only times that it's been at that level, 2021, 2001, and then back in the 1960s. So we're historically overextended from a total stock market value standpoint. And I think that like Buffett's making 5% on cash, at least. He's probably making more than that. Why plow into stuff that is maybe fundamentally overvalued if you're making a reasonable return on cash and you've already got a portfolio full of positions that you like?
Yeah, he said 5%. I think he said every Monday he's been buying with 3, 9 month and something else. I can't remember the lengths of time. Basically, bonds. and or sorry,
T-bills,
right. T-bills. Excuse me. Yeah. And just like plowing more money into that every Monday, which I'm sure has worked well for him. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could look at it two ways. First, you can't go wrong with, you know, if Warren Buffett is telling you that the market, the no fat pitches to swing at right now, and the market's overvalued or too overcooked or however he's phrasing it, you can't go wrong. You're going with what, you know, the world's greatest investor, at least world's greatest value investor, thinks. And there's also the old Jesse Livermore quote of, markets are never wrong, opinions are. And you know, the market's been telling us for 6 months that people are buying. And until it tells us otherwise, I don't think people should go into their bunkers. You know, it's different for Warren Buffett, because when he invests, he's investing billions of dollars. Whereas, you know, we individual investors, we don't have to put that much money in. You can buy a few hundred dollars worth of whatever stock and see where it goes. And I think it's still a good time to buy, but it's also a good time for caution. I guess that's sort of been the theme for the last few months. You know, that was the theme before we had this big April pullback, and now it's back after two really good weeks here in May.
Yeah, I think the sort of structural difficulties that Warren Buffett faces are a very valid point. If he wants to take a position in something, he may have to file with the SEC. It may take him weeks or months to accumulate something. So if he's looking at it and saying, okay, well, we're trading at this really high valuation, is there anything that I want to take 2 weeks getting into that if things go south, it's going to take me 2 weeks to get out of? Or do I just want to keep making 5% and bide my time until a screaming opportunity appears? Yeah, that's something that is definitely a constraint that Buffett has that individual investors don't have and that we don't have. If you want to buy 1,000 shares of Apple, Celsius, right, Atlanta Braves, like whatever, you don't have to file with the SEC. It doesn't take you 2 weeks to do it. You put in one order, and then if things start to go sideways, you can get out in 5 minutes, unlike Buffett, who has to watch things grind down for a couple of weeks while he like closes positions into a declining market. His risks are significantly different from our risks, but his assessment should probably guide our assessment a little bit.
Yeah. And that's why it's very valid to, caution is definitely a very valid stance right now. And, you know, Warren Buffett saying it just further enhances that for sure. But, you know, those who invest in value and growth, it's still a bull market. So I think you can do both. You can keep buying stocks, but also doesn't hurt to have a little safety, whether that's in the form of, you know, reliable dividend stocks or, you know, having some bond yields in there or whatever.
Even position sizing, right? Like there's a lot of ways to there's a lot of ways to mitigate downside risk without entirely going to cash or avoiding upside potential. You take smaller stakes than you normally would. If you are using like a sector allocation, you put less in the high growth stuff and you put a little bit more in value, right? Like there's ways to sort of mitigate disparate valuations without, it's not an all or nothing proposition to be maybe a little bit more cautious, but without sacrificing growth. Cause that's the fear, right? Is that we hit the soft landing and 6 months from now, the S&P's trading 15% higher, right? Because then you've missed out on significant gains because you're concerned about, say, a macro picture that might take 6 months or a year to play out, right? You have to sort of balance that. And part of, you know, I skew a little bit more conservative, so I might balance it by underweighting stuff. If you skew more aggressive, put your stops on tighter, right? Like there's steps that you can take to mitigate risk without sacrificing all potential upside. And maybe it's start selling covered calls, right? Like if you're like, hey, I've got this position and it's gone up a lot, I'm not ready to take profits, I think it's got more room to run, but I want to mitigate some risk. All right, well, collect some premium for the next month and sell a covered call on it. And that offsets some downside Should it head lower? And if it does, you close out your call and you close your position. All right. So there's ways to manage around it. It's not an all or nothing proposition.
Well said. I think that's a podcast. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Couple things to know. First, as always, whether you're listening, wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever, or watching on YouTube, like and subscribe. Give us a nice review, all that good stuff. You are out next week. I believe it's your birthday. Is your birthday next Friday?
Yep.
Friday. Happy early birthday.
Thank you.
You are out. I think family trip to Chicago. Is that correct? So I will have similar to you when you had Larry Chung, when I was out a couple of weeks ago, I will have to be determined co-host here next Friday, or maybe I'll just go solo. Colin Cowherd style. We'll see. I don't think that the listeners will want that, but we'll see. So thanks for joining us this week, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Street Check.